This podcast is recorded on stolen and unceded Aboriginal land.
We acknowledge the First Nations and elders of this country, and we join their calls for justice.
I mean, it's like, you know, when we were talking about having more babies and we're pro-baby, the real reason we said that is because forklift drivers, the new forklift drivers.
We need more kids out there operating heavy machinery, please.
Goo goo gaga.
To get Australia, to build back a better normal, we need little kiddies out there driving forklifts to ease stress on the national supply chain.
Yeah, exactly.
So people thought it was a joke, right? People thought, oh, is this a Tracer article or what have you? But absolutely, the Prime Minister did seriously suggest the idea of allowing under 18s to drive forklifts to help out the supply chain. And I don't know what the various takes was, like people saying, hey, we're not talking about children, okay? They're 16 or 17, so just chill out. And other people saying, hey, you know, we need all the ideas we can get in order to fix this crisis. And so get the little kiddies out there driving around.
Some people saying it was all a big-brained plot by Scott Morrison to distract us.
Really?
Yeah. You know, it's like almost Russiagate style, where we overestimate. Leftists are like, we keep losing. They must just be smarter than us. And they've got this big, massive plan.
So what the idea is, he puts out this sort of dead cat idea of like this wacky thing to distract everybody from the fact that everyone's dying from COVID and catching COVID and no one can get a test or healthcare during this pandemic, even though we're 2 years into it. And then we're all talking about forklifts and then we're not talking about that stuff. Is that the idea?
Yeah, that's my understanding. Or, you know, I guess the dead cat. So when we say a dead cat, that's like this, I don't know, theory or analogy or whatever for when you like throw something on the table that is just so wild that you can then come back with something less wild and people are like, oh, at least it's not a dead cat.
A cat that's been run over by a 15-year-old operating a forklift.
Exactly. So, yeah, then whatever he says after this is not as bad as letting children drive heavy machinery. And so we'll all just accept it. I don't think that he had any strategy behind this, though. I mean, I think that it's not even, I think the US also proposed something similar.
Neil Mitchell says the Prime Minister was shouted down too quickly. I think it's a very city-centric reaction. If you think about country areas, kids are driving tractors from about 14, the 3AW Mornings host said. In New Zealand, you get a forklift license at 15 years old. I mean, you know, again, I have no fucking idea. I don't know how to operate a forklift. Look at these hands, Emerald. Look at these soft hands.
I think that's true that, like, when you're a kid, like, especially outside of the cities, yeah, you jump on a tractor or in the car a bit younger. But, like, that's usually in a family environment or at least, like, a very small production scale. It's not to, like, ease supply chain issues with massive corporations whose primary motive is, like, extracting this child's labor to make an enormous level of profit from it. Like, just prime exploitation breeding ground. Like, it's just, yeah, not the same, buddy.
I also love pairing it with Frydenberg this week going after unions, militant unions, quote-unquote, which is people in unions who don't want to go to work if it means they're going to catch this deadly disease that's destroying society.
Militant unions also don't want the child labor.
You can't do anything anymore. It's PC gone mad.
I know. Fucking cancel culture.
Talk about the Greens. They're funding that bunch of idiots.
The Greens is a party of hatred.
You know what the Greens are? They're a bunch of opportunist drops hiding behind a gum tree trying to pretend they're the Labor.
Frankly, I've always found the Greens to be a real serious danger to Australia.
Serious danger to Australia.
Activate podcast. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Serious Danger, a podcast about Greens politics in Australia. I am Tom Ballard. With me is Emerald Moon. Hello, Emerald.
Hi, Tom.
Have you stopped complaining about how much your body hurts after you've been working out?
I will never stop complaining. I do the gym now. It's my first ever time. I'm going to get very strong.
Very strong.
I'm in a lot of pain.
This is an independent podcast. We are not an official Greens Party podcast. We're not spokespeople for anybody. We're too powerful and insightful with the truth. And they're scared of us. And we're not allowed to be an official podcast. So just keep that in mind.
I'm not even a spokesperson for myself.
Great show for you this week. Of course, January 26th, everybody's favorite day that causes no controversy or horrible feelings of crippling guilt, is coming up in the next week. We're going to be chatting to Professor Chelsea Wadigo, author of a fantastic collection of essays called Another Day in the Colony. She'll be joining us to talk about black sovereignty and why we should say fuck you to hope.
We are going to be shitting on the GST. I can't wait for that. But first off, we wanted to get into the people's questions, Emerald.
Serve the people. I love to do it.
I love the people. Last week on the show, we asked you to send in your questions for us. We've been, is this episode 9? We're episode 9. Episode 9 into Serious Danger. Like we figured that a loyal, huge army of listeners would have some questions about us, about the Greens Party, about the show, about what the hell we're banging on about every week. And you got in touch via email, via Instagram, via Twitter, all the places to ask us some cues for us to A.
I was so surprised by some people, like when people sending in questions, I think I still assume no one really listens. And I was like, did you hear the show about the AMA or are you just sending me a question by coincidence? Because you can't possibly be listening.
There are lots of people out there listening. We're building a movement. We're starting the revolution here, Avril.
A movement,
yes. Some might describe them as disciples. Like Ryan on Instagram. First question here. What advice would you offer inexperienced candidates running in the federal election? There's a couple of questions about being a candidate here. Emerald Moon has experience as a failed candidate, a candidate that lost. And,
my answer is don't do it. No.
Why?
Just kidding. Just kidding.
Kidding. Okay.
Advice is have good people around you. Have people who have campaigned before you around you and don't get candidate fever, which is what we in the biz, some folks may have heard the term candidate fever before. I heard it the first time when I was running as a candidate, where you just truly believe, even if you are in a very safe Liberal seat, for example, that you're going to win and you deserve like all the resources and spotlight on your campaign because it's the greatest ever.
Right.
And you're going to win. Get it a little bit because it's kind of fun. And that's probably what's driving 90% of campaigns. But don't let candidate fever fully take hold.
I've heard about this.
Seek help if systems persist. Yeah.
Yes. And being insane or having no grip on reality is obviously bad for anybody, particularly a political candidate. But I also think, you must do, you need a little bit of delusion to keep you going, to get you to wake up every day.
Yeah. The motivation, but then there's like the paranoia side of it where you think that your campaign is so important that everyone is also simultaneously going to vote for you but also out to get you.
Right. Oh, God, sounds maddening. Look, I got nothing but love and respect for anybody who puts their hands up to be a Greens candidate. I just think, there are people here who do it. You know, it really is a huge, huge dedication of time and energy and probably endangers one's mental health. And it's just, it's just a big deal to do, even if you are running in a seat in which the Greens have no realistic chance of running, right? You know, and they're not just paper candidates. They're people who are out there, still doing the stuff, talking to people, engaging in debates and engaging with psychos on social media. I just think it's amazing. And there's some incredible young people, particularly, who put up their hands to be candidates in 2022. And I just think that they rule. So much love and solidarity.
Yeah. And it is not like, as much as you may feel like, oh my God, it's me putting myself out there. If you're, for example, if you're running for the Greens, it's, you've got like thousands of people behind you.
Yeah. Speaking of, relevant to this, Callan from Perth got in touch. Callan is supporting Carolyn Perks for Perth, Greens candidate. Thumbs up to that.
Perks for Perth.
Which electorate do you feel the Greens have a chance at winning at in this election other than Adam Bandt's own seat of Melbourne?
Griffith!
Shout out to Griffith. Very quickly, there has been these 10 or 11 targeted seats that the Greens have been talking about where we have a decent chance. And Griffith certainly is up there. A primary vote in 2019 of 23.7%, and that was with a massive swing. There was 6.7% swing to the Greens candidate, Max Chandler-Mather, who was running again in 2022. We've discussed him on the show before, marshalling this extraordinary people-powered campaign, knocking on every single available door in the neighbourhood. And, you're part of it, Emerald. It's going quite well, I assume.
Oh, I've done like 2 door knocks because I've been lazy so far. But
that counts.
Yes.
That counts.
As someone in Brisbane, I'm required to say Griffith's going to win and also Ryan and maybe even Brisbane.
Pretty amazing. I mean, in Brisbane, the primary vote in 2019 was 22.4%. In Ryan, it was 20.3%. So, around 20% mark. McNamara is this formerly Port, Melbourne Ports in Victoria. Steph Hodgins-May, once again, the candidate there against Labor's Josh Burns, 24.2% is the primary vote there last time. So that could be a decent chance. The highest primary vote is actually, after Melbourne, of course, is the seat of Wills, with 26.6% in the 2019 election. So that's old school Bob Hawke territory. Peter Cleal, the current member, 26.6% of a primary vote there. Shout outs to Sarah Jefford, who is the federal candidate. Four wheels for the Greens. Much power and strength to you, Sarah, and to all candidates running everywhere.
Yes.
I don't know. Is it worth talking about, you know, the realistic chances, or is it just like
chance at winning?
It doesn't fucking matter, right? Just you campaign your hearts
it
out.
It does matter.
Your heart out.
It does matter very much whether we win. Thank you.
No, totally. But it's like there are these lists of 10 or 11 seats where the Greens primary vote is substantial. It's climbing. There's been swings to the Greens in those particular seats. It's still a tough ask. It's an uphill battle. But at the end of the day, as a Greens member, if you want to get involved in your local campaign, fucking do it, you know?
Well, yeah. And like beyond those seats, every single seat usually will be fighting to elect someone in the Senate.
Yep.
And the only way that we win the Senate seats is through those campaigns, yeah, in the lower house as well. And Senate is just as important, arguably even more important for the Greens. So
yeah, but also Griffith, you say?
But also Griffith. Sorry, I forgot to say also we don't know the answer to this question until we see the sports bet odds.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's important.
That's the real, yeah.
From Tyson on Instagram, favorite books, fiction or nonfiction, political or non-political, or just whatever? Didn't you read a million books last year?
Well, yeah, exactly. So I could only maybe think from the books that I read last year. Actually, one of the least political books I read, but I still think about how enjoyable it was Pure Invention by Matt Ault. And it's about Japanese pop culture. And it just is filled with these like really fascinating little tidbits of info and facts that you factoids. And it's just really fascinating, kind of looks at, yeah, like trajectory of Japan's economy and politics a little bit and how that tracks over their production of like popular culture.
And talk about their debt, the level of debt that Japan is in, even though they're not really, because they're basically doing like MMT and the central bank just buys up all the debt that Japan's in and it hasn't resulted in hyperinflation, which means that
also,
maybe money's not real and everything's fine.
Money's not real. That's true. Money's not real, like Hello Kitty is.
Yes. We should move to a pure Hello Kitty economy. It seems to work out well for Japan. One of the best political books that like changed my life in a way was Eating Animals by Jonathan Safran Foer. I read that years and years ago and was a pretty shitty vegetarian for about 5 or 6, oh no, maybe about like 8 years after that, following that. I've since abandoned it because it's delicious and I'm shit. But if you really want an investigation into the way that animals are subservient to our needs and the horrors of factory farming, etc., Eating Animals by Jonathan Safran Foer is very good.
And if people are genuinely interested, I did do like a Twitter roundup of the books that I read last year.
Go to my Twitter.
Year.
You can see all the books I read. I'm Barack Obama.
I'm Barack Obama, everyone. Sure. Fucking whatever.
This is from Peter on Twitter. Really enjoying the podcast. Thanks, Peter. Would love to know what you and the Greens make of the influx of independents. Most are small L liberals, ? Pro-climate change action, good, but how do other small L liberals' policies compare? Help defining small L liberal. Appreciate it.
I have so many thoughts about the independents.
Indeed.
The climate independents I have many thoughts about.
Which I would say there's so much to chat about that we should maybe do it in full as a full conversation on a podcast in the future. But it is... it is remarkable. It is, you know, we yet to see how much of an influence it will roll out in this upcoming election. Certainly getting a lot of media attention at the moment. And on a very consistent basis, I think if you go through the policies and the issues that many of these independent candidates say is really important to them, you kind of go, hey, you could just join the Greens maybe, because the Greens have been talking all about this and has the advantage of being a political party. But
and it makes you wonder which of the Greens' policies, economic justice,
right,
are they not as interested in?
Not so much.
Or, you know, building a mass movement that can actually take on capital. That's a sneak peek of my take. Well, I think we should do an episode where we talk about it in depth.
Damien Irving via Patreon. As someone whose only experience with political party membership is with the Greens, I struggle to get a sense of just how differently or not we operate compared with other political parties. From reading Education of a Young Liberal, I don't know what the fuck that is, but don't read that, Damien, would be my advice, and watching the Adam Somyurek saga in Victoria, it seems like the primary grassroots activity in the Liberal and Labor parties is branch stacking warfare between staffers. So how are the Greens different to these other major parties, both like structurally as a party, I suppose, is the question, Emerald?
Well, I have to say I haven't been in any other parties, and someday I've been thinking it would be good to have someone who has been in Labor or even the LNP or the Liberals and then moved to the Greens, who actually knows what it's like differently as a member. But, I mean, I do know that the Greens have, like, good democratic processes and accountability to members. All our policies are set by members at big meetings where we do what we call consensus decision-making, which is both incredibly painful and difficult and also very good democracy. We pretty much all have to gasp compromise sometimes and figure out, or, like, if not compromise, argue for what we believe in. And sometimes, yeah, and get other people to come around and be like, yep, that makes sense. And our MPs are then, yeah, accountable to members. The one thing I would say that we are not as democratic on is how we elect the leader. People probably know that I have feelings about this, and I think Tom does too, because the leader of the Australian Greens is just selected by the, what, like, 9 MPs that we have, and members get no say.
Yeah, it's decided by the parliamentary Greens Party, and there was a vote, was it last year, to try and change that, to try and get direct maybe in the year before, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I think so.
Yes, to try and change that, and it will also vary, you know, the processes within the parties will vary by the different state that you live in, because each state has their own Greens Party with sort of their own traditions and histories and structures and such. But, I mean, yeah, I think it is really key to underline that Greens members vote for the people that become their candidates, unlike the two major parties.
I forgot
when
that other,
members do have a say, they can give a little bit of feedback and some influence.
Oh, my God.
But the state executive or the party executive could often say, "Nah, we want this person, please, because they've given us shitloads of money, or because they're
so
friends, or they're my dad, or whatever." I don't know. And they say, "No, this is your candidate now." And you'll see this a lot. You'll see, you know, Labor parachuting in a whole bunch of people who often have no connection to the local community, and the local members get fucking furious. And fair enough. And they say, "Well, why the fuck am I paying money and spending the time and energy to be part of this party if I can't actually have a say on who we're putting up as our representatives in these upcoming elections?" Another question here, courtesy of Paul Wilson. His frustration with the Greens is their inability to connect with working class voters, which is doubly frustrating because they, working class voters, would benefit from many Greens policies. I'm from a working background. A lot of my extended family think the Greens are crazy. They're anti-sugar, anti-horse racing, anti-gambling, and don't care about workers in mining. How do the Greens shatter this perception? If we don't, then our vote isn't going to get much higher than the 10 to 11% than it currently is. Another massive, massive question, Emerald.
Yes, and one I think that is very valid and came up again recently with that article about the Queensland Greens and connecting with, working class voters and moving out of just the environmental kind of snobbish inner city frame, which I think we will probably want to dedicate more time to in a future episode. My short answer would be I think that, like, recent platform changes and messaging changes have, like, affected our ability to do that, and particularly led by Queensland Greens, I would say. But let's talk about it more in the future.
I think so, down the track, yes. And I would also just say the general point that absolutely, I think that's a fair enough critique, and the issues of how the Greens relate to class is totally valid, worth considering. And if we want to become a mass party and become more successful as a political party and make things better for most people, we're going to have to deal with that. At the same time, a lot of these critiques are made in pretty bad faith. They're by people who don't know much about the party, who will never give you credit, even if the Greens do put up candidates that are from, you know, working class backgrounds or have policies that appeal to working people and what have you. So just be conscious of some of those critiques, because sometimes even if you put up these candidates or these policies that have resonance for working people, as they should, then the argument will immediately switch to, oh, well, you can't do any of that anyway. So just shut up, Greens, go away. Question from Matt Morgan, who is the Greens candidate for Monash. Shout out to Matt. I believe he's from the Young Greens as well. Question for the show, how do you convince older voters that young people aren't idiots? As a federal candidate in Gippsland, the older demographic seat of Monash, the most common question I get from people when I'm out campaigning is, how old are you? Should I continue just smiling and being friendly about it? Or do I say, 3 times younger than the unvaccinated Liberal MP I'm running against?
Is this something you came across a fair bit when you were out there campaigning, Emerald? You were dismissed as a silly little girl?
I think yes. I think I came across it, but I actually think embrace it, because a lot of the time, one of the most effective ways to talk to voters, particularly older voters, especially if they have kids or grandkids, is to note that the reason that you're doing this is because you care about, you're worried about your future and you want to fight for it and you need their help. And I think that increasingly, like, yeah, a lot of older people are willing to listen, and seeing someone stand up who's fighting for their future and their friends' future and, you know, their kids' future is very valid and inspiring.
Yeah. And as I say, shout out to all young people putting their hands up for this. Yeah. Jordan Still John, one of the most impressive members of the Australian Parliament at the moment, is also the youngest. And I think your tactic is right, Matt. I mean, if people say a young person can't be involved in politics, politicians are grown-up, sensible people who know lots of things. And you go, I'm sorry, are you familiar with the current crop of ruling class fuckheads who are ruling over us in the Australian Parliament at the moment?
Prove them wrong. Yeah, just go and prove them wrong. Like, the more smart young people run, the less defensible that view will be.
Totally. Okay, last question for now. Thanks so much to everybody who submitted questions. You are all legends. We appreciate it. And there were lots of them. If we didn't get to your question, it's not because we hate you or don't like your question. Chances are it's because we want to go into more depth about that question and that issue in future episodes, FYI. But this last one comes from Daniel on Instagram. It's fuck, kill, marry. All right, here are your options, Emerald.
Yes.
Karl Stefanovic, the Today Show version. Kevin Rudd, Silver Fox and Beard version. Tony Abbott, firefighter version. Kill, fuck, marry those three gentlemen.
Fuck.
Over to you, Moon.
Shit. Oh, my God. Well, because I can't not kill Tony Abbott, can I?
I guess that's good politics. That's praxis, I suppose, yes. This is all jokes. Anyone from ASIO who's listening, this is all parody jokes.
Kevin Rudd probably be away a lot, but I just don't think I could stand it. Maybe I just marry him and he'll be away a lot. I'll fuck Carl. And, yeah, kill Tony. What are you doing?
I want to marry all of them. No, I'll go a little bit different. I'll fuck Tony Abbott. I'll hate fuck Tony Abbott. I'll kill Kevin Rudd for backflipping on refugee rights. And I'll marry Karl Stefanovic, because I did interview him once, Karl Stefanovic. He did a little live show I did, and he was actually quite charming. And if you just accept the general Stefanovic vibe, if you just kind of get on board the train and think you're a funny man who does ridiculous things who I don't have to take very seriously, I think that's probably the key to a successful marriage, you know?
My choice was stupid. You're so smart, Tom.
Thank you, everybody. Good night!
That's why the Commonwealth Government is introducing a new tax system for Australia. It's a system that will move our country forward, not hold it back.
All right, I'm about to get a little bit Marxist on y'all.
Uh-oh.
And talk about taxes. two certainties in life, Greens being Marxist and taxes. So this week, the alleged economist Stephen Hamilton published an op-ed in the Sydney Morning Herald arguing that lefties should get on board with doubling the GST to 20%.
What?
Did you see this, Tom?
I sure did.
Yeah, it's kind of all over Twitter.
And I've always been a huge fan of Stephen Hamilton ever since he wrote a piece for the AFR where he's about Labor's climate policy, saying, when you're provoking outrage by both the left and the right, it's a good sign you're doing something right. He's one of those guys.
Yeah, because he opens the article by talking about how he's a centrist, which already makes me feel very ill.
Sure.
The article is entitled Why Lefties Need to Learn to Love the GST. And he goes, if there's a more misunderstood Australian policy than the GST, I haven't found it. I'm a centrist kind of guy. I don't buy into the tribal loyalties on either side. Blah, blah, blah. But so, yeah, like when you fucking start with I'm a centrist kind of guy, you've lost me already. But I wanted to talk
right-wing.
About...
He's right-wing. Like, whenever anyone says it's,
yeah. When is, yeah, centrist. You say centrist, you're right-wing. And if you are centrist, right-wing. I hate you anyway because, like, have an opinion. You fucking coward. There are, like, a few arguments.
Surely a centrist position would be to go for 5% GST.
5%, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or 10, keep it exactly the same, which is usually one. Yes. The centrist one.
Right, yes, change nothing.
Change nothing. He makes a few piss weak little arguments about, like, throughout the article about why he wants to increase the GST. But I wanted to focus on one of the at a certain point, he starts arguing that if you want wealth taxes, then you should like increasing the GST. So I am going to, I'm just going to read this. He says, by taxing more of what they earn, a higher GST operates as a kind of Buffett rule, ensuring, or buffet rule, Buffett?
Buffett, Warren Buffett.
Ensuring, Warren Buffett, okay, ensuring the rich like Warren Buffett, get it, pay no less in tax as a proportion of their income than the middle classes. In this way, the GST is implicitly a wealth tax. Is there any real difference between taxing 10% of someone's wealth and taxing 10% of everything they could ever buy with that wealth? Yes. the answer is yes.
Yes.
And the reason the answer is, okay, to start, like, I would like to just let everyone know that I'm not pretending to have read Das Kapital by Marx. I haven't read it. Fucking sue me. I'm sorry. I've read the manifesto, the Communist Manifesto. I haven't read Capital. But I do know that this is just like completely ignoring the fundamental characteristics of capitalism, which is the economic system in which we live, that like our economic system is driven by accumulation for accumulation's sake. Like it's driven by money for money's sake. And I did find a quote from Capital that says, the relations of capital assume their most externalized and most fetish-like form in interest-bearing capital. We have here money creating more money, self-expanding value, without the process that effectuates those two extremes. And that's relevant because, like, I think the wealthiest people in our society at the moment are making that kind of interest-based capital, right? The interest-bearing capital, because they just invest their money. They don't spend it.
Right. They have shitloads of money, and so they're not spending it on things that they have to pay GST on.
Yeah.
So the argument does work. I mean, he's sort of saying that, hey, you know, rich people get all this money, but when they buy their Ferrari, then they have to pay GST on that. There you go. But as you're saying, they're just also sitting on giant piles of money at the moment. There's a shitload of capital just sort of sitting there that's just becoming more and bigger and bigger and getting more and more money, and a wealth tax would do something about, you know, trying to dissuade people from doing that and trying to actually, you know, make capital a little bit more active rather than just sitting there and not actually producing anything. GST can't help us really do that, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I mean, returning to the conversation we had about wealth transfers and how the Productivity Commission was using that concept of relative wealth inequality to talk about how when poorer people get a bigger sum of money, it means more to them. Like, this is where that actually should be applied, because it's like for poor people, they spend more of their money because they need to spend more of it for basic necessities of life, whereas wealthy people would just fucking invest it and they make money off of that.
Yeah. And this is what makes the GST regressive, right? When we talk about a regressive tax, we're saying that poorer people, we pay a larger proportion of their overall income and wealth having to pay GST. And of course, the richer you are, the less you care about having to pay GST on various items.
Yeah, exactly. So as opposed to like a progressive tax, which is theoretically decreasingly so under liberals, but theoretically where we tax the higher earners more and we tax lower earners less, and we have, you know, a certain level of income that's so low that they don't even pay tax because they probably need all of their money to live.
Mm.
Almost again, like, I guess if you applied, I mean, I wouldn't say that Marxist, like that communism or Marxism is predicated on a taxation system. That's maybe another argument. But if you applied the principle of from each according to his means to each according to his need, that's progressive taxation. These kind of like increasing the GST just has no regard for means. It just says that everyone should have to pay the same regardless of what it actually means to you or how it will impact your life. And ultimately, it'll just impact poor people more.
Yes.
When you're talking about the Ferrari example, so in this article, this alleged economist is like, well, the good thing about this and increasing the GST is that it would catch people who would otherwise evade income taxes. So he literally says, like, if you inherit $10 million, you don't have to pay any tax on that. But if you buy a Ferrari with the money, then you should have to pay tax on that, blah, blah. It's like, okay, so you just argued for an inheritance tax. Thank you. Good. Yes, true. We agree. And if you're talking about it'll catch people who would otherwise evade the income taxes, you're talking about people who fall under the income tax threshold, who otherwise wouldn't pay tax because they don't earn enough to.
Yes. I mean, you could also, yeah, just have a way better tax system that catches that kind of exactly. stuff. So when you talk about the Buffett rule is the idea that you have a basic level of income, like a floor, basically, that rich people can't deduct underneath. And I think in the 2018-2019 tax year, something like 73 people who are millionaires who made over $1 million paid $0 in income tax, right? Because they were just able to deduct to the point where they paid nothing in income tax. Now, obviously, you do that by spending shitloads of money on accountants that can help you fix the book so that that's how it ends up. And also you can claim those tax accountants as a tax deduction as well, which is like really fucking messed up. So yeah, the Buffett rule was supposed to say, well, you know, no matter how much money you make, you're always going to pay a minimal mm-hmm. amount of tax. And the wonderful champion of the working class and the people who are serious about wealth inequality, the Labor Party, have just abandoned that rule. Anthony Albanese was a long-time proponent for introducing something like a Buffett rule. He was recently asked, will Labor be taking that policy to the election in 2022? He said, no new taxes for anybody whatsoever.
No new taxes.
That'll just be fine.
Yeah. But yeah, like this, it's such a fucking, it's a stupid article. It's so stupid that it almost feels like deliberate trolling. And it really is just a perfect argument for taxation initiatives that actually target the people who need to be targeted, i.e. billionaires. And if you look
at hang on. We should tax the people who have heaps of money? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, but only via the, as I think someone said on Twitter, the 80,000, you know, Maggie Noodles packets that they will be buying. Because as we know, that's how it works. Like, anyway. Yeah, I mean, we can put the link in the show notes if people want to go and read the Greens policies. But 6% tax on the 122 Australian billionaires would be like 40 billion over 10 years. So, but yeah, 4 billion a year, theoretically. Corporate super profit tax of 40% on big corporations, an extra $34 billion a year over 10 years. And if we end Australian government fossil fuel subsidies, so money basically handed out to fossil fuel corporations, they're handing over like $10+ billion a year. So if you're looking for places to get some money,
mm-hmm.
I have some ideas that don't need to come from people fucking just struggling to live their lives.
Also, you know, this article completely ignores the history of the GST. When it was introduced by the Howard government in the late 90s, it was going to be even worse, right? The original GST included no exemptions for fresh food, yeah. for healthcare, for medicines and educational services.
Yeah.
Howard rejected an exemption for tampons. Yeah. They were considered non-essential items and were subject to GST until 2018.
Just hold it in.
When, full credit to the Greens and Labor, you know, fought to finally get that done. I think condom and lube were GST free, which is pretty fucking extraordinary. Yeah, which is exactly what the patriarchy is all about.
Like, to be clear, they should be, but
sure, yeah, yes,
so should tampons.
But yes, the hypocrisy was something. But also, yeah, at the same time, the Howard government was cutting company taxes and lowering, you know, income taxes as well. The threshold for the highest income tax bracket, you know, went from something like fucking $50,000 in 1996 to 180K by the time Howard had left office, right?
180K, you know,
that's where it shipped in.
Struggling to get by some of those folks, Tom. So maybe before you speak with this politics of envy stuff that you've got
on. Sorry, everybody. It's fucking bonkers. My other favorite thing about GST, in fact, have you ever heard of Mr. GST Emerald?
No. Who is that, John Howard?
I read about this guy for the book that I never finished. But in March 2020, Finance and Accounting magazine In the Black profiled Kevin Feheley, who was a member of Peter Costello's GST Technical Advisory Committee. Feheley was so integral to the design of the tax that he gained the moniker Mr. GST, a nickname that he still honours today with Mr. GST number plates and a tattoo reading Mr. GST on his right bicep.
I swear to God, he better not fucking come to Brisbane, cunt.
Good stuff. All right, our guest this week is Professor Chelsea Wadigo, aka Chelsea. She's a Wurundjeri and South Sea Islander woman born and raised on Yagara country. She was trained as an Aboriginal health worker. She's a prolific writer and public intellectual, former tweeter, not so much these days. Her debut book is a collection of essays entitled Another Day in the Colony. Hi, Chelsea. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. Look, I'm just on a break. Me and Twitter are just on a break.
What happened? Did it burn you?
It was a bit of a new year, new me kind of moment. I've got a hell of a lot of work to do, both at home with five kids and with work life and my other side hustle. So I just need some time to just focus on some of that stuff.
Your brain can rebuild the pathways it loses.
Yeah, and, you know.
You got to make time, Chelsea. Twitter's important, and you need to dedicate the time and energy to getting angry online and just arguing with randoms. That's really important.
I mean, my apologies to Blackfella Twitter, but I'm actually not missing it.
Surprised.
Miss the mob, but, I've just got stuff to do.
Yeah.
Well, Another Day in the Colony sort of originates from Blackfella Twitter. It's an expression that kicks around a lot, and it is the title of this collection of essays of this book that was released towards the end of last year. For folks who don't know, what is the colony? What are you referring to when you mention the colony, and where did that expression sort of come from?
The colony is this country right now, and since 1788. So we talk about settler colonialism, which is a different form of colonization, and it's one in which the settlers never leave. And so we, you know, Australia, US, Canada, New Zealand are other examples of settler colonial states, of which we share some histories with, some experiences with. But it's a different form of colonization. And so this talk of, you know, a post-colonial moment for me seems quite absurd because we're engaged in an ongoing war in this place.
Right. And that colony is celebrating its birthday, quote unquote, from 1788, coming up very shortly on January 26th. I'm sure we're all extremely excited.
You didn't get it a present?
Party planning committee has not formed yet. Hate to break it to you, but
yes.
Leaving it very late. But you are involved in the sunrise ceremony that's going to air on SBS and NITV. And just for folks listening, I'd love to hear your thoughts. How do you relate to this day and this time of year and this cultural debate that comes up every single year? How do you think about it as a proud Black woman who's interested in First Nations justice?
Yeah, look, it's very Groundhog Day. It's sort of the same old shit. And I've kind of got mixed feelings. I'm no longer in the camp of change, abolish, or maintain. I think that arguments across that, I think 26th of January in this nation celebrating its birthday on that day, I think reflects the truth of this place, of the kind of nation that this is. In holding it on that day. But at the same time, whether they abolish, change or whatever, 26th of January will always be commemorated by Blackfellas. Every year I go to, you know, rallies and march, and we end up at Musgrave here in Meanjin. And it's a day in which we celebrate our sense of nationhood, and you see it on the signs like still here, the chance of always was, always will be. It's a sad day. You know, we every year at a rally we're adding names to our dead that were killed at the hands of the state who have not seen justice. But also just I love that my kids get to walk through these city streets having those sounds ring through their head, seeing so many Blackfellas turn out. It's a day that reminds us of our survival and our existence that we're still fighting to have recognised in any substantive way. And so irrespective of what the settlers do and how many snags they chuck on the barbie, 26th of January has a meaning for Blackfellas that we will always commemorate regardless of what day they change their birthday to. Yeah. And I think that's the thing. I think if you, you know, when you go to those rallies and marches, you see what it is to be truly proud of your people and your nation. And Blackfellas, what they don't realise is Blackfellas, we're modelling that every 26th of January.
Yeah.
Because it involves truth-telling. It involves celebrating who we are. It involves commemorating our losses. we tell a rich and full story on the 26th of January about our existence as a people. Mm. One that they continue to ignore. How very Terranullius of them.
Terranullius is as does. Do you invest in keeping that in mind, invest in the conversation around attitudes towards that day changing? I mean, last year the ABC's Australia Talk survey found the majority of Australians now believe that this day, Australia Day, if it exists, shouldn't be celebrated on that date, given the historical significance of the date for Indigenous nations. So 43% agreed in 2019, the big survey that the ABC did. That's ticked over to 55% now. You know, the conversation is brought up every single year. As you say, it's kind of like Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
Is that a sign of a meaningful change or anything, or is it just kind of more culture war bullshit in your view?
Yeah, well, like, I think on the one hand, when we're seeing the growing numbers of people turn out, particularly across the cities across the country, we can see that there are becoming fewer citizens that are celebrating Pride and genocide and choosing instead. And I've even in the last 10 or 15 years, just here in Meanjin, I've seen the change in terms of, it used to be a handful of mob that meet at Musgrave and march, and it'd be all the pubs and clubs would be open and everybody at South Bank's fake beach celebrating a fake nation. Just want to throw that in there. And, you know, now when we march through the city's shut down.
Yeah.
No one's out. And a few years back, they used to have fences up as we came through past South Bank to keep the blacks out of their little celebration. There's nothing there anymore. I mean, I think it's funny, but my interest is not in appealing to settlers and somehow getting the validation necessarily on that day. So I no longer invest in the argument or the debate, because everyone knows it's ridiculous to celebrate this nation's birthday on that date. We know the nation has a much richer and longer story that started way before 1788. Mm. And it's this nation's refusal to see that. You know, every year we have a former or current PM that tells this lie about the modern Australia and the modern nation. It's a load of bullshit. Mm. We're the oldest living culture in the world. Why wouldn't you be proud of that? Why wouldn't you want to celebrate that, amplify, recognize all of that? This day and the way in which the nation state commemorates it tells us the truth about where we're at when it comes to the relationship between settlers and blackfellas.
Yeah, I think one of the, just like when I first started going to the rallies in Brisbane, Meanjin on 26 January, and like as a white person marching along and you're chanting all the chants and then there's always the chant that goes, you know, who owns this land? And the response is, we do. And that, I think, is a pretty stark moment for a settler to then be like, oh, that's right. Who's organising this rally? Who is this rally for? Who's this about?
Yeah.
Which is what I really like about your approach.
So what do? You like whisper, they do? Or like...
every time. I think I just be quiet. That's probably...
all keys.
Yeah. It's funny though, because I think a lot of the white people are like, oh, what do I do here?
Yeah.
I'm like, probably just shut up.
It's very hard for us to do, though. We do love talking. It's very cool.
Yeah, that's right. That's why it's so confronting.
Well, Chelsea, this week ahead of the 26th, the Greens political party are going to be revealing their Truth, Treaty and Voice policy initiative. It's led by Senator Lydia Thorpe. And I'd be interested in your thoughts because, you know, more details to come and we'll maybe reflect on them on the show next week once it's out there in the public sphere. But she says, in announcing this initiative, this day of mourning, let's transform our grief into hope for the future through truth, telling and treaty. And we love hope. Everybody loves hope. Apparently. It just makes everybody feel nice and good.
Right?
In your book, you have an entire essay entitled Fuck Hope, which you're making the case for retiring hope as a strategy for black emancipation, and you're really calling to embrace nihilism as a part of that emancipation, or more realistic path to perhaps a better future, or to true living sovereignty for black people in this country. Can you tell us more about that argument? I'd love to hear you talk more about that.
Oh, look, it's a whole essay. How do I paraphrase? So it's drawn the case for nihilism. I'm not really making case for nihilism, I guess. I've drawn upon Paul Beattie's The Sellout, when he talks about stages of blackness, and he talks about this final stage as unmitigated blackness, and it's the not giving a fuck, you know. It's the night in jail, the serious actor. It's no longer caring about appealing. And what I liked about, what was refreshing about that, is he said sometimes it's the nihilism that makes life worth living. And so it's the life worth living stuff, you know, as a people with tragically high suicide rates, this current strategy of hope, of new days, a new dawn's breaking, a brand new day, it's betrayed us. It's failed us. And I've seen too many broken fellas betrayed by hope, you know, that go to work in white institutions in the hope of change, in the hope of that they can fix things. From my own home here with my ex-husband as a former police officer, to Aboriginal health workers working in the health system, to Indigenous liaison officers in schools, to private companies who have all been broken by the lie of hope, having invested so much in it. And so for me, I love truth telling. As ugly as it is, as Jimmy Chi refers to it as, sometimes the truth is too ugly. Truth for me offers a sense of freedom. And it means that the strategies that I deploy then are very different. And I'm really interested in if we accept that we're in an ongoing war with the state and all of its institutions, we need to think about how do we preserve black bodies in that war? How do we better armor them up? Mm. And hope is something that has taken our armor away and made us susceptible, more susceptible to the violence of racism that we experience, because it rests on the idea that at the heart of things, settlers and all of their institutions are caring, are benevolent, are virtuous and are innocent. And if we look to the foundations of this place, it's always been violent, physically, psychologically, you name it. So when I say giving up hope, it does not mean we don't fight, that we don't have anything. And what I return to is the premise of remembering who the fuck we are and where we come from. As black fellas, we start every engagement with each other as that. And so when we go into battle, we should be foregrounding Indigenous sovereignty, our own individually and collectively, and not vesting it in the hope of white people because, sorry, they failed us.
There was an article in the Monthly, I think, last month by Megan Davis about truth-telling that was sort of about, like, beware the ally spruiking truth, you know, in the absence of justice, where it's just about dragging black people's trauma out to kind of make white people feel better and then be like, okay, we can move on now that we've done that.
Yep.
What do you think of that?
Yeah, look, I haven't read it, but I've had yarns with Megan about truth-telling.
Yeah.
I have a real issue with truth-telling because typically it means us bearing our wounds, us speaking of our trauma, while at the same time ignoring the violence of the state, both past and present. And very rarely do we get to tell the truth about the state. And I've had that experience as an academic, commissioned reports for coronial inquiries or commissioned reports for the Queensland government, where they've tried to silence those reports that tell the truth about state-sanctioned violence. And so viciously, even though it's referenced and footnoted and evidence-based, the state is fairly insistent upon continuing the lie of this place and the lie of their presence. And so for them to preach about truth-telling when they won't tell the truth about who they are, that's the issue. And so when I say about let's tell the truth, let's tell the truth about this place, and then we get to remember the truth about who we are as a people.
Yeah.
You know, it's so bad. I hate the trauma discourse. And sorry to the trauma people, and I know trauma-informed practice, and it's really important, but that trauma discourse has been weaponized against us. I mean, Mariki Onus, I remember, tweeted last year about, you know, the problem with that trauma story is it, and intergenerational trauma particularly, is that it says that there was something wrong with our grandparents in how they tried to survive in this place, that it's a failing of us as a people. The response to trauma often isn't structural. It's always about remedying individual behaviours, and it always seems to turn out that the answer is better, more control over blackfellas.
That's interesting.
alcohol management plans, emergency interventions. It legitimizes the state to continue to exercise further control of our lives in every aspect of our being. And we need to be really conscious about how that discourse is working upon us.
Yeah, deflect, all the focus is on the problems with First Nations people, not problems with the state. Maybe some self-reflection.
Right.
And,
yes.
Yeah, and even the intergenerational stuff, it's like it's continuing. Like we have, you know, second generation deaths in custody.
Yeah.
Like it's not a past thing, it's ongoing. And so to talk about trauma as intergenerational, often it's seen as the problem happened somewhere back then and now it's up to us to fix it. Yet it's still happening. And there's still no response to the perpetrator in any of this. It's all about victim blaming.
Mm. Just so I get this argument sort of straight in my head, if I can, and maybe it's not for me. You've made the point that some of this book is not primarily for pale people like me, and that's totally fair enough.
But
when we talk about, you know, the shit the First Nations people face in this country, and the intervention, if we are not to imagine or to hope for a better future, if we don't have that relationship of hope to a tomorrow in which people aren't dying in custody, in which, you know, the communities aren't managed, in which those alcohol plans aren't in place, where there is real sovereignty recognized in a meaningful, tangible a law in this colony, if we are not to relate to that through hope, how do we get there? How do we envision? How can we fight for it if not without the hope as the guiding light?
Yeah, I mean, so I think hope's a useless strategy. I think, you know, progress is a lie in a settler colonial state. It's what the state does to continue to assert its virtue and innocence. But that doesn't mean I'm not invested in the fight every day and everywhere. And so for me, it's about finding joy in the fight, not being sedated by this idea of hope that comes from somewhere else at another time.
Mm-hmm.
In real time, we're engaged in a fight every day, whether it's, you know, going up to the principal's office to pull them up about the violence they inflict on our kids in the course of teaching them, to workplace race discrimination cases and reminding mob who they are in the midst of those fights, and to the, you know, the legal shit that we deal with. For me, it's just going, look, we're always going to be here. We're always going to be in this fight. And we may as well have some fucking fun doing it. And how do we have fun doing it?
White people would say, live in the moment.
Live in the moment.
Live, laugh, love. Yo. Is that what you're saying?
Okay, got it.
So for me, it's about I've now redirected as a consequence of abandoning hope in white institutions. My labor intellectually, politically, and legally is invested in building black things. Mm. So it's about. We're still fighting and still doing stuff, but the foundation on which it is based is not black lack and white hope, but black power. And there's so much joy in that space. And we do things differently. And in having that foundation, we are in the midst of the fight reminded of our power and our strength and our capabilities and innovation. Just refusing that role of service to settlers, whether it's in an appeal or resistance to, has been life-saving for me.
It's called Another Day in the Colony. It is out through QUP, Queensland University Press. Dr. Wadigo, Chelsea, thank you so much for spending time with us and all the best, for this week, I suppose, or your ongoing sovereignty. And we really appreciate your time.
We'll have some fun this week.
There will be fun. There will be joy.
Some of the focus on issues like the date or the anthem are simply a distraction from the hard choices and hard decisions that need to be made about those other issues, because they have proven to be intractable.
Yeah, and those issues aren't being
you can do.
We shouldn't
sideline those issues and focus on these trinkets.
Yeah, well, those issues aren't being fixed, and it's not just the current government; it's previous governments as well. I mean,
that's right.
So, folks, if you're looking for something to do this week, it should probably be about the 26th of January, particularly if you're not Indigenous. Give money to a local First Nations organisation if you can. There's a website, paytherent.net.au, where you can contribute. But ultimately, if there's a local like First Nations group in your area, best to support them. You can also, there are a few rallies that are happening around different cities. Some are online, a lot are online, some are in person. I think there's an in-person one in Brisbane. If you're thinking of going to a rally in person, use common sense, like stay home if you have any symptoms or you've been in close contact of COVID, wear your N95 mask, stay distant from other folks. Otherwise, yeah, jump on an online event. We can put some links in the show notes. And you can also donate to support the three-day conference that the Aboriginal Tent Embassy is holding over the 25th, 26th and the 27th of January.
Yes, it is the 50th anniversary of the Aboriginal Tent Embassy, which is pretty fucking amazing, and an extraordinary history of that part of First Nations resistance and justice. Anything you do to help them out would be awesome.
Perhaps most important, you know, if it's on the 26th of January, making it known to friends and family around you why you're not celebrating Australia Day that day, and talk to folks about the real history of this country and what you're doing instead.
That's our show for this week. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you very much for submitting your questions. We love yous. We hope we did those questions justice. Serious Danger is produced by the wonderful Michael Griffin, made possible with the help of the Green Institute. You can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening. We got a shit review, Emerald. We've made it.
I know.
This is a one-star review. Listening to wannabe intellectuals make lame jokes is too depressing / wince-inducing for my liking. High school politics students have more interesting things to say.
I mean, that's probably true. Go listen to some high school politics students then.
Yeah, get them on the board. Alternatively, if you like this show, then you could maybe flood our Apple Podcasts area with really nice 5-star reviews. That really helps us spread the word, gets more people to listen to the show, helps us grow up. That would be awesome.
And it'll put a smile on our dials.
Yes. Sorry, FL Boar, for letting you down. You can support the show on Patreon too. You can follow us at SeriousDangerAU on Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Subscribe to us on YouTube. That'd be great. Or just head to SeriousDangerPod.com. Thank you, comrades. Thank you, Emerald.
Mwah.
Serious Danger, Australia.